Hey, Jamie, I've got a question for you.
What do you want, Tom?
Who's on the podcast this coming Friday? Is it someone big?
Boy.
Is it a big one? Shall I bother listening this week?
Yeah. If I was going to say take.
And I would say off.
No.
Your trousers.
No, no. Take.
Me out.
No. Take.
Paddy McGuinness.
No. Take.
Take on me.
Take that.
Wow.
Have a little patience.
But hang on, presumably you haven't got all three of them, have you? Presumably you've just got one of them.
Buddy, we have all three of them on the podcast. They've released a new album. It's coming out. They're going on tour. They talk about the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, on everything that happened in Take That.
The ins, the outs.
And they reveal it all this Friday.
Exclusively.
On Private Parts.
That's a big one. I'm going to listen to that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Boy,
I'm
very
need?
Excited. The roles have reversed.
Yeah, hang on a second. You're like asking me questions. This is...
Right, I'm about to open you the fuck up.
Well, I've interviewed you how many times have you?
Oh shit. Yeah,
see, that's what I thought. I thought it's a good question to ask you because I genuinely don't know the answer.
Have we started this and you're already trying to interview? Imagine that. He started this podcast, he's already on it. I love it.
No, no, but I've interviewed you so many times. It's nice that you're asking me questions.
You have. It is an odd feeling because you have been very present for quite momentous parts of my career. Honestly, right, you've been
really?
There. Yeah, wow. You were on the phone to me as Down With The Trumpets charted for the first time into the top 20, or maybe it was 22, I think. I can't remember. But it was somewhere near, and we did a little thing in Brit School.
Yeah.
It was dope. And
I'm
sorry. Any grunts you hear on this recording, by the way, are just recorded. It's my dog Spike. But yeah, a few times, mate. And also, most recently, you interviewed me on your podcast, which, if you aren't really subscribing to, you should subscribe to.
Thank you.
The Reggie Yates podcast. And the response has been mad.
Yeah.
And it's quite a bizarre feeling for me because I remember very, very consciously feeling like it was quite weird. because sometimes I feel like I don't have a filter.
Right.
And, you know, you asked me like very open, a couple of open-ended questions, and I feel like it was like a bit of Pandora's box kind of thing.
I love that though. I mean, I think that's part of the reason that the show is doing okay, I guess, because it's me and a group of pals and nothing is off limits. And you get a lot of people say that about their shows and about, you know, we make the podcast where anything's okay to talk about. Genuinely, that's the idea. And the nice thing about having guests on, which we don't do very often.
Right.
Normally, the show is just me and my mates chatting.
Oh, okay.
And we only get people on that we like that we find interesting. We can't stand you, but we find you interesting, which is why we had you on.
In it? I rate that.
No, because you're a nice guy, you've got a lot to say, and you're also doing some incredible work with I Am Whole. I was so excited to have you on. And the reaction to me was huge. People saying, oh my God, he's amazing. Where can we find out more, etc.
Oh, great.
And I'm really glad that actually came through to you as well.
Yeah, nice. Honestly, and to an audience that I would, I hadn't had access to at that point. You know, you forget, people have observed me at different stages in my life. Some people are aware of things I've done. Some people remember me as a little teeny bopper and that. I love that phrase.
Yeah.
But
such a visual.
I don't know, teeny bopper, label. I don't know. But yeah, as like an 18-year-old, I was running around like completely, like ADHD was just on full 100%. My diet was awful. My sugar levels were just up and down like a yo-yo.
But you're in such a lovely place right now. A lovely space, should I say. It's just amazing to be
honest. I am doing better. But this podcast is about you. So I want to say thank you very much for reversing, for, you know, doing exchange.
Yeah.
Because we haven't been going as long as your podcast, I don't think. And it's fantastic for us to have a guest of your stature.
Oh, wow.
And okay. Very much an inspiration to me. You know, sometimes I play it down, but like, you know, you're a G8, so it's blessed. firstly, I want to shout out to anyone wearing a hat.
Yeah, we're in an exclusive club on camera of two at the minute. So yeah, welcome to the VIP.
Yo, it's just, that's the ish right there. I mean, have you done many podcasts when you're being interviewed?
Yeah, a few. And it's always weird because, well, I think the closest thing to making a podcast for me out of all the things that I do is my documentaries.
Mm.
Because in the shooting, at least, not so much in the final edit, but I'm sure you know this, when you're making a documentary, you're making anything factual, you just go. You just have these conversations. You don't have questions. You're just interested in the subject matter and you sit with someone and you talk unfiltered. And that then gets cut down into what ends up as the final film.
Right.
Those unfiltered long conversations, long form conversations, should I say, are what make up the podcast. And it's really, really nice. Going on other people's shows, it's weird being given the opportunity to talk nonstop and continuous about yourself.
Yeah.
Because I don't do it anywhere else and I don't really like doing it. I don't know if I dislike it. It's weird. It's not because I'm guarded or sheltered in any way. I think the default for us as Brits is to be overly humble and you're very aware when you might be veering into showing off as a Brit. And as a Ghanaian as well, you know, my mother and father were born in Ghana and I was raised in a very strict Ghanaian household. It's similar in terms of the culture, which is that you don't show off, you don't talk about yourself too much, you don't say too much, you sort of hold everything down. So between the Ghanaian culture and British culture, I find it quite unnatural to talk at length about myself.
Yeah.
Which is why I found therapy difficult to begin with, because it's kind of like, talk.
So like, so you find it difficult in total, so there wasn't even like an intersection between like humility and emotional expression. It was just a total close down.
Well, it's not even a shutdown at all. There definitely is a middle ground, but at the same time, it's just that thing of being aware, like, oh, am I saying too much about myself? Oh, am I bigging myself up too much?
Oh, not occupying too much space.
Kinda.
So being low maintenance was seen as a...
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like when I started doing my podcast, I remember talking to a friend about the show and she was saying, oh, yeah, this person on the show talks too much. I was like, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, if you had a color chart of the voices, there would be just one color dominating it. Oh. And I was like, oh, God, yeah. And I don't want to be a color chart. I don't want to be that dominating color in any conversation. I'd like to be the bit that comes in and out but makes the picture beautiful, if that makes sense.
So, wait, hold on. Explain that again. Your friend said to you that she felt as though you would never want to be a dominant colour in a conversation.
Yeah.
Is that subjective?
I guess.
What would
everything
be considered?
Is.
So you're looking at, I quite like that image actually.
Okay, so if
you're looking at a conversation as you're like painting, mm-hmm. and you just don't want to add too many brush strokes.
Of one colour. Yeah. This conversation ideally will be red, yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow, red, yellow. Even though
that's
it's about
those two colours don't complement,
but you know what I mean.
Horrendous.
But you know
McDonald's.
What I mean. For the home and away, for an Arsenal fan. But
oh,
yeah,
true.
That's why my brain went straight away.
Blue, okay.
So it's red, yellow. You'd want it to be a bit of both. You don't want it to be just red and then a little bit of yellow and then red. That's not a conversation to me. Think I'm in love with a singer, yeah, but I want to get richer.
Life threw me a bag of lemons. No wonder I'm bitter. You feel as though there's a pressure from not only your British heritage but your Ghanaian heritage to not take up too much space.
Yeah, to be humble, really.
See, I think those are two different things. That's what I was saying about an intersection. Like, humility and modesty, I'm all here for.
Mm.
And I think that playing down maybe achievements I can kind of see, but not occupying space is minimizing your because there's like for example, I'm someone who will often apologize too much, or I'll begin a sentence by playing down an achievement, and a lot of people do that. I've noticed. I actually saw a video about it. Yeah, so it's kind of like, when actually there shouldn't be a shame, especially around people who you love, and just being like, I feel great about what I've done.
Yeah.
I've always struggled with that.
Well, it's finding the balance, isn't it? And I'm still a work in progress in terms of that, striking that balance of talking openly about the things that I've done and that I feel that I've done well, and being aware of being a bit too loud about some of your achievements or right. some of the things that people might put you on a pedestal for. So yeah, it's just being aware. And I think given the lane that I'm in now,
that's tough, man.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's a difficult balance to strike. But yeah, I think part of the reason why it's so on my mind is because the lane that I'm in now, or known for most now, which is making factual programming, usually speaks to quite important topics and subject matter and things that people really care about. So when you're constantly being pat on the back for your work in a field that you're not an expert in or that you're not the subject of,
right,
you kind of have to juggle that praise in quite a careful way. Because if someone says to me, oh my God, I loved your documentary on homophobia within the Black and Asian community and the communities in the UK, it's like, okay, that's very kind, thank you, but I didn't really do much outside of ask the right questions. The people that were willing to give, in my humble opinion, are the stars of the show. The director that was able to shoot it and create an atmosphere where these people were willing to give is just as important a part as me. And it's all these things that sort of play on my mind when it comes to talking about some of the successes.
And you say that that kind of mentality, despite what you've just said, clearly having, I suppose, a valid place, you know, in terms of not allowing space for other people, actually, you have also said, I think you said something along the lines of therapy was difficult because your kind of mentality carried into that?
Difficult is maybe the wrong word. It was almost like sort of shaking off a certain muscle memory. And that is when someone gives you the forum to talk about the things that you struggle with, you should just be, you know, just let it flow and not sort of be conscious, as it were. And I think that, you know, when you go into an environment like therapy, which is a place that I've found myself in for a while now, it's very easy to sort of think you can game it when conversation is what you've used to pay your bills for the best part of 30 years, you know? So when you're sat down with someone who knows all the tricks and knows when you're hiding behind a joke or pretending to be someone you're not because you don't want to deal with the thing, I think it's a really humbling experience. And it's amazing because you learn so much about yourself. And also you start to see it in other people, and you start to see when other people are doing that. But yeah, I see it as an education, and both in terms of self and also in terms of dealing with others and communication as well.
How old were you when you first went telly?
8 years old.
Eight?
Yeah.
What were you doing when you were eight?
The first thing I did was Desmond's. It's funny because weirdly there was a clip of it on TV the other night. Now I don't watch the show, but that's another conversation. It was on the Big Nasty Show, and they had Zowie Ashton as a guest.
Yeah, we just did Zowie Ashton on the last
right. Zowie's my co-D. We did our first ever job together. So they showed a clip of her first job, which was Desmond's, which happens to be a Channel 4 show, and it was her and I who play in brother and sister.
Oh wow.
But yeah, we went to primary school together. Like, I've known her for as long as we were in the same drama group, so we started out as kids together.
Actually, we knew that because we told her that you were next and she said to go fuck yourself. A joke. No, that's dope, man. That's dope. Mm. I mean, dude, to be in a spotlight from eight, I mean, I grew up watching you on Smile. Mm-hmm. How old were you when you were doing Smile?
We started that when I was 18.
Don't lie.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. Mate, I was telling you before that Nev's Jam It Up got me in so much trouble.
Yeah. A lot of people loved that game. Bro, it was a wicked game online.
They tried to block it in my school, but you could still get onto it because it was a BBC site. So I was just there like boom, boom, smashing it. Anyway, I failed IT. But like, what effect did that have on you? Considering the extent of time that you've spent in the limelight, brush shoulders with people who have been overexposed or had public struggles.
Constantly, pretty much, because a lot of people have. And being young when you start, it's really interesting making friends who are in the business too and seeing how they deal with it, you know. Like, there's lots of different moments where I've kind of gone, wow, I'm in a really different place to this person or that person. And a lot of the time it comes down to, in my humble opinion, either decision making or your circle, you know?
Right.
I always get spoke. People always ask me about why I don't drink, smoke, take drugs or anything like that. And that's not because I'm holier than thou. And that's not because I'm better than anyone or I'm smarter than anyone. It's a combination of things, I think. And the point I'm making is the home that I came from didn't allow me to be anyone outside of the values of that house. So the African cultural part of my upbringing was a huge thing. So much so that when I was a kid and I was on TV, my mum would always say to me, you can't behave like your friends because you're from this house. That was the first thing she'd say.
Is it?
And the second thing she'd say is, you've got something to lose. And it was like, oof. And she was right. Because literally, if I misbehaved, and I don't know if you, it wasn't the case for you, because when you started, you were 17, 18. So you were out of that chaperone age group. So when you're in TV or music or even in a musical on stage in the West End or whatever,
yeah, you got to have your mum.
You have to have a chaperone. My mum worked, so she couldn't do it. So we had a chaperone come and look after us, right? So there are people who make a living for chaperoning little kids under 16-year-olds, and you can only work a certain amount of hours.
Yeah,
and those hours that are given are signed off by your school and your GP. Like, it's weird. There's lots of things, hoops you have to jump through, right? So I did that for 8 years, from 8 to 16, having every single job that came in, and I did really well
even
as a kid.
Through secondary school?
Absolutely. Whoa. So here's the thing. If you misbehaved in school, your head teacher would just say no. Like, I'll never forget, I got a McDonald's commercial when I was in school, in secondary school, and my head teacher just said no. And he didn't have a reason why, because I was a straight A student in secondary school.
Yo.
But he just decided he didn't want me to do something because I was just working.
Thing.
It was crazy. So my mum would always say to me, you've got more to lose than your mates. And she was right, because it wasn't just being grounded and not going to play football. It was, I would literally lose money and I would lose an opportunity to build my career.
Blimey.
So that was always in my head from 8 to 16, that a teacher who didn't like me or who I pissed off could block me from working.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You've been sober your whole life. Love it. I love it. But do you think actually that must have really held you in good stead to survive what I'd say is almost the, I don't know what it is, that feeling of being exposed to, that's a big thing, to be in the spotlight for so long. That must have really helped you. To just be able to have that stability.
It's difficult because I don't want to come across as being very black and white about it, but I have to sort of go back to the beginning to answer that question properly, because I've always sort of seen it in a very clear way.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that comes from the way I came into the business.
Yeah.
So I started out as a kid, and all I've ever known is the parameters in which I came into the business. And that was what I was being told at home: don't fuck up.
Yeah.
Because if you fuck up, this stops now. And I loved it so much, I didn't want to fuck up.
Yeah.
And then also the place in which I trained. I say trained in inverted commas because I never went to a stage school. I never went to performing arts school. I went to a local community drama group called Anna Shear. Anna Shear was £2.50 a lesson. My first book that I wrote is dedicated to Anna. It was just a thank for Anna Shear, thank you, because she gave me this career. This is an incredible, incredible woman who was a matriarch for an entire community. And so many of us went through Anna's. It was a cheap theatre that you went to. I paid £2.50 a lesson. And because I was so much of a little prick and so much of a little show-off, I got on what they called the casting card quite quickly. And then I went up for auditions, I went for castings, and then I got work.
Yeah.
And I've worked consistently since. And I've been incredibly fortunate to work for such a long time, but I couldn't have been more blessed than to have gone through Anna's. Because above the doors at Anna's was a sign that said, there's no such thing as star or fame.
Nice.
And then on one side of the wall, there was a poster of India and it had Mahatma Gandhi. And the other side, it was a poster of Africa. And on the other wall, you had Martin Luther King quotes. And from the age of 8, we were drilled to be grateful, to understand humility, to look at philosophy, to look at poetry, to understand quotes. And all of these things went in.
wonder I'm bitter.
How did you know you wanted to perform at 8? Like, surely there was something that led up to that.
Yeah, my dad's a musician, and my mum definitely isn't. She isn't creative particularly, but I'd watch Jackie Chan, and then I'd get 7 or 8 kids from the estate to my bedroom. I'd charge them 20p, and I'd do kung fu lessons.
Really? And you didn't know kung fu?
Didn't know. I'd watch the movie. Mm. I'd have 2 radios. I'd have my mum's Ghetto Blaster from the kitchen, a little
but
blaster.
But why?
That Uncle George did. It's just,
I want to get to know, but there's a thing in you.
Let me get to it, right?
Right.
So what I'd do is I'd have 1 radio on this side, and then I'd have another Ghetto Blaster on that side, and I'd turn up 1 radio, turn it down, do a link, and then turn up the other one, right? To go from song to song. So I was going in between songs, and I'd like play radio station on my own in the room. And my mum, off the back of seeing this, knew that I had this energy and needed to do something with it. So in my humble opinion, right, some people are born with a need to connect, right? And my mum believes that everybody's born with a gift, and I agree with her. And some people are born communicators, and some people just aren't. Some people fake it, some people learn it, but some people are born with it, right? I'm not saying that I'm a born communicator, but I'm definitely someone who enjoys performing, I guess, who enjoys not the spotlight so much, because I don't need it. If I'm at dinner with a group of friends, it doesn't have to be about me. I don't need the spotlight, but I definitely get off on that thing that happens in a room when everybody's having a good time.
Yeah.
So like, I
are you an only child?
No, I'm one of 7.
7?
Yeah, there's a lot of us.
How many?
And I'm not the youngest or eldest.
Were you in the middle?
Third oldest. So like, when there's
all in the same yard?
No. Sort of blended, but there's 7 of us. So like, whenever there was a house party or whatever, I would take the mic and I'd put on a record and I'd introduce it or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was me from being a kid. And I'd see the reaction I'd get and I'd be like, this is sick. I want to do this more. And it wasn't, it didn't feed something in me, but it did, you know, it didn't make me. Yeah. It didn't make me need and crave attention, because I've never got off on that. What I've got off on is that weird thing that happens. You know, when everybody's laughing in a room and everybody can feel something happening, or if somebody's really emoting in a beautiful way and everybody can feel that thing. Even as a kid, I recognized that was like a superpower. So that, I think, is what drove me to do what I did.
Very impressive.
It's not impressive. It's just...
Well, I mean, look, all that imagery and almost childish excitement just leads me to ask the next question, which is, what's the lowest point in your career? Like, you were in your worst period of mental well-being, perhaps. It might not be to do with your career, could be.
Yeah, it was when I went through a breakup. I was engaged and I had to keep working even though I was at my unhappiest. And that was really tough, because I think there's an expectation that you're always going to be okay. Mm. I was talking about this today, actually, with Bubba, who's on my podcast, my friend Bubba. And I think when the perception is that you're successful, that you've got it all, you've got a nice wardrobe, you've got a nice car, you've got a nice house.
Mm.
You're on TV, people see you and they love you. People like your social media posts. From an outsider looking in, you live a perfect life. Everything goes well. Whatever you do, people say, oh, he's great. I love him to bits. But when you have some sort of personal turmoil, like, you know, I've had issues with my family, I've had issues in relationships and so on and so forth. And this was particularly difficult for me, because there's only so much you can say publicly when you're a private person. You know, and as a massively private person, if you are in a situation that is private and it becomes public, it's very difficult to navigate that, especially when you're not being spoken about in a favorable way. So to have to sort of...
Was it made public, this whole situation?
Yeah. Oh,
I didn't
so
know.
To be... I'm glad that's the case.
Okay.
To be in a situation where you actively have never and will never publicly speak about a personal relationship, let alone a romantic one.
Yeah.
For that to be shouted about by a lot of people is quite difficult, because what do you do? So battling with that while making quite difficult documentaries about other people's pain was tough. So that was one of the most difficult times, I think, that I've had to deal with. I call it walking in love, right? It sounds like a ridiculous notion, but I genuinely walk in love, which is something that I learned from some of the more tough points in my life, and that is that everybody behaves a particular way because of something. People don't just don't just do, right? Outside of how you're born and what you're naturally drawn to, right?
Some kids hurt people, don't they?
Well, there's that, but also, you know, I think that some people have a propensity to communicate really well. Some people are really, like, from the womb, they have this ability to make people feel good or make people smile. But at the same time, because as I said, I'm a private person, I think when you do have a public profile and you are a private person, it is very difficult to navigate those moments when you just don't want to do it. And I think if at the core of what you do is transparency, honesty, and objectivity, it's hard to put yourself on camera or on mic when you're hurting.
Yeah, because you know you're gonna, you know you're just gonna be.
It's gonna come out. And through putting myself through that, by that I mean being on camera through the toughest point, I had no choice but to sort of not even swallow it to heal.
Oh right,
yeah, and to heal while making
meaning about the walk in love thing. So it's right. Like you were utilizing your space to reflect back on the situation.
Exactly. And also the walk in love thing for me really comes from this idea of trying to understand why people behave the way that they do, to see past the anger and see past the frustration and understand where it all genuinely comes from. A friend of mine and I had a conversation recently about forgiveness pertaining to this exact situation, right? And he said to me, he's an amazing guy, an actor. I'll say who he is. His name's Nicholas Pinnock. He's one of the nicest men alive. Nicholas, if you're listening to this, I love you, brother. You're an amazing person.
Shout out, man, like Nicholas.
Shout out to Nicholas Pinnock.
He's Nicholas?
One of my good friends, and he's like a big brother to me. Nick dropped a bomb on me in terms of forgiveness, and that was that when you're really struggling with somebody's behavior, the best way to forgive them is to imagine them as the person they were when what caused their behavior happened.
Trust me.
Right? So in my situation, I was instantly transported back to this person as a child, and you can't be mad at a kid.
That's so real.
Right? So I forgive the kid because the kid is still alive. You know, the kid is still in that person, and the kid is the loudest voice in that person's heart and mind. So for me, forgiving that child that didn't grow up is way easier than trying to argue with the adult who I'm faced with.
100%.
You know? So to walk in love, to me, a huge part of that is forgiveness.
I've never got to tell this story on the podcast purely because it's kind of a little bit disconnected, but I just think with you speaking about forgiveness, it's an interesting thing to share with you. Mm. Because it just stayed with me. Again, when I was actually at a really low period of my life, and I was during a breakup, I ran away to Brazil. I told you that already, and I thought that was really unique. Turns out it's not.
If you were wearing dungarees and bandana, then you definitely weren't unique.
Oh. But yeah, my uncle is a very wonderful human being. He's called Gideon, and
Uncle Gideon.
He's a documentarian as well. He did a short piece or a piece in prison and interviewed a guy who was responsible for like a ridiculous amount of murders. And the maddest thing about it was he was so openly happy about killing people. Like he was like, I love seeing someone's head explode in front of me. Like I love killing people. Like he just didn't care.
Wow.
So they did a thing with him where they took him for it with a shaman and he did I think it was something along the lines of ayahuasca. He did a kind of hallucinogenic.
The criminal did this.
Transcendental experience. Yeah, the criminal. And he came back from this experience, you know, and he was completely shifted. But what I think is really interesting is, it's not in the way that I preempted, because what actually happened was he saw one of his victims, right? And what the victim said to him was, I forgive myself for being killed by you. And apparently after that, he lost all that. He lost all of his power. Because he's in that moment, he realized he was happy to be the bad guy.
Mm.
There was a power in being a bad guy. Mm. He was taking power away from other people.
Yeah.
But in that person going, you know what? Yeah, man, I shouldn't have been in front of that gun. He's gone, there's no power for him now, and he's just totally reformed him.
Wow.
Forgiveness is there's a reason why it's so tough, and the payoff is so amazing.
It's so powerful.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've learned through understanding forgiveness better is that some people have a lot of anger in them that they haven't made peace with yet, and they can't shake it, and it's down to them to shake it. You can't shake it for them.
Oh, no, of course not.
And so long as you're understanding of that and willing to either support them lovingly and emotionally from a distance, or being involved in the actual rectifying of that issue, I think forgiveness is the safest and best thing you can do.
Was there a moment when you were like, because, you know, like I was saying to you on your podcast, I literally had a panic attack.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, something's not right here. Was there like a moment like that for you, or was it just preempting something?
No, I've been really fortunate to have mentors around me from quite a young age, and I refer to them as bits of dad, because I didn't really have my father around, and my stepfather and I have never had a good relationship, so I wouldn't really count him as an influence on me.
Is he still your stepfather?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's still in my life, but we don't really have a relationship. And as a result of the years I spent with my mother prior to her meeting my stepfather, she gave me this set of tools that helped me identify what a good role model actually was, which I only realized in hindsight was beautiful, the way that she would talk about good men and the right kind of man that I need to be around.
Right.
And as a result of those tools that she gave me, which I only realized later, I chose mentors who were the bits of dad that I needed to sort of grow in a healthy way, I feel. So like, I had someone who would talk to me about finance, someone who would talk to me about football, someone who would talk to me about girls, someone who would talk to me about telly. And these were all different men,
bits of dad,
that were just amazing bits of like the perfect dad, I think. And
that's great. Are you working on that as a
book? It's a book. It's a book I've
got
to
say, because that's dope. You know what I mean?
I've spoken about it too much now. Someone's probably going to write before. No, if don't. They do, good luck to
listen
them.
We'll do a version with that, because that's a bad boy idea.
Yeah, no, but
you can't, because it's your life. No one's going to steal that. Like, that's quite a unique experience.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Some of us have been labored with the same old clunky dad. No, I'm joking. Sorry.
I bet he's going to love that.
Oh, he's all right. He's all right.
But these bits were really unique in helping form me in a lot of ways. And one of those bits of dad was a guy who I met in my mid-20s. I bought a house from him, and we became, he's a property developer, and we became super close. He became like a big brother slash dad.
Mm.
And after being friends for about a year, he was like, "You ever thought about therapy?" And I was like, "Oh, why'd you say that?" And he was like, "Yeah, you should probably speak to someone." I was like, "What's wrong?" I was like, "No, you just need to speak to someone." And quite quickly, we sort of head on, my therapist and I went into some of the more difficult things that I hadn't quite dealt with yet. And then once we were past that, it was more about maintenance. And I say past.
You're so good at not mentioning the things that you hadn't dealt with. It's like almost
if you want to know, I'll tell you. Yeah,
I'd love to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had because it's past tense. I had a difficult relationship with understanding. I had a difficult relationship with father figures.
Right.
And that's why it kind of isn't. That's why it's in my work a lot.
Mm.
When I write and direct drama, that's there. I can't get away from it. It's still coming out of me in the stuff that I make.
It's grief, isn't it? It's like a
yeah, kinda
a void almost. I feel that.
I think so. Yeah, I think it was to begin with. It was a lot of anger, and then it became a struggle to actually understand, and then it became forgiveness, and then it became understanding, and now I feel like I'm in a better place with it. And
right.
I think a lot of that will come up again when I'm a father myself.
Oh my God.
You know, I can only imagine what's going to go on in my little pea brain when I've got kids, especially boys. Good Lord. But
yeah,
there was a lot of that.
It's an opportunity to break a cycle.
That's part of, unfortunately, I've sort of realized that, so much so that it became a bit of a pressure, and then that was something else I had to work on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's like
those weird games that we play with ourselves, where we sort of self-evaluate so much that we create things that aren't actually there. You know? So, yeah, I mean, both professionally and with an amazing group of friends and with incredible siblings, and through reading really, really good books, I feel like I've done a lot of work that has got me from a place of being incredibly guarded and protective to being open, but also understanding what is right to share and what isn't right to give away.
We often talk about music a lot on this because we launched our first Music for Mental Health last year, which was a massively wonderful success. Mm-hmm. I hope you can come to this one this year. I mean, what's your? I know you made used to make music. I remember listening to it on your MySpace. I remember listening to a song called "Monkeys in the Arctic."
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had a tribe called Next. I remember I was into that. But like, what is your relationship with music now? And specifically, are there any artists, songs, albums that like define a part of your life? Maybe you can't listen to anymore. Maybe music you listen to, you know, in that relationship.
So artists that define a part of my life. I'm a London boy, and UK garage and jungle are a huge part of my formative years. So like being at secondary school and everybody going mad over Jungle Hits, the compilation, because it had all the biggest songs on Pirate on one. I've still got Jungle Hits now, and you just play it from, you know, from one song to the next. These are the songs that just define a moment in time when you weren't old enough to go out, but you'd have raves in your headphones in your bedroom as a kid, you know? Yeah, like you just wanted to be there. It was so aspirational. And then Garage came along and it was made by people who weren't your age, but they were closer to you. They were like only 3 or 4 years older. Like I remember being in secondary school and Heartless Crew were like 16 and 17 and they were gods to us. We all wanted to be Mighty Mo or Bushkin. No one to be funny, no disrespect funny, but everyone wanted to be Mighty Mo or Bushkin because they were out front holding the mics. And so Garage is a huge part of my formative years, but there aren't really albums to reflect it when it was at its purest because it was all pirate.
Yeah.
It was all pirate radio. So those tapes, those literally classic cassettes, I still have.
Ripping them
and
off.
They're, yeah, they're like...
Hi-fi.
Exactly. They're super special moments that we keep. But yeah, Slum Village, fantastic volume 2, Like Water for Chocolate, the Comet album. I can never forget playing... The first time I played a song down the phone to a girl was a song, I think it was...
You played a song down the phone to the girl?
To a girl, yeah. It was off the Common album. It was off like Water for Chocolate. It
Why?
Might have been.
Did you play it down
the phone?
Because
I was just like, this is... Because it was mobile phones, isn't it? You just put the phone to the
and
speaker.
And you just went like, yo, vibes out
I was like, have you heard the new Common album, man? I've been listening to it all week. She's like, no, I heard it. And I was check this song out. Oh, I was like, I'm going to play it from the beginning. And I played it to her down the phone. I'll tell you,
The entire song?
Yeah. I shit you not. I'm not making this up for an anecdote. Genuinely, I put the phone to my ear and I heard the toilet flush and I heard her run back to the room. She was like, oh no, I just had to go. I just really needed to go.
To be fair, if someone put a whole tune on when I was on the phone to them, I'd be doing other things.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that.
Bless her. I don't think she was into it as much as I am. But
what's your favourite colour?
I didn't think I had one until I looked into colour theory for this thing that I was writing. Uh-huh. And I then realised that my favourite colour, it's not a colour I wear, I don't really own much of it. Like pretty much my wardrobe is black, navy and beige because I'm that challenging.
Well, I think that bodes well with your idea of not taking up space.
But green. I really like the colour green. And
what type of green?
Olive is my personal favourite.
Olive green.
In terms of the colours that I own, I only own a musky green.
Yeah, like almost khaki.
Yeah, exactly. So I own a lot of that in terms of clothes. Well, I own a bit.
That's good
the only
as well.
Kind of green.
That's good.
But when I looked up colour theory for this thing that I wrote, so I wrote this short film. And the character I wrote was called Ashley Green.
Yeah, wait, are we talking about the one I've seen?
Yeah, maybe, I think
what,
so,
outside
yeah.
the newsagents and then he
yes,
goes to the art.
Yes, exactly, all right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that, I was writing,
stoke film.
I wrote that and then I realised, and then the therapist in it, her room was
Jessica
green.
Hines.
Jessica Hines played the therapist and so Tossin Cole played the main actor in it.
Yeah, he was dope.
He was great. And green kept popping up throughout without realising. And then when I looked into colour theory, I realised that green is the colour of change, transition,
positivity,
growth, so on and so forth. And there's so much that comes from
and we
colour.
See more shades of green than any other colour.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, we see more shades of it because apparently evolutionarily we had to be able to detect predators from the grass. So our eyes are accustomed to understanding the different shades.
Wow.
Okay. going back to your life.
Yeah.
What do you think's been your best period of mental well-being?
I think the periods of growth, really. There's nothing better than a light bulb moment.
Mm.
And when you have a moment where...
Epiphany, if you will.
Absolutely. When you have an epiphany, it's like the best thing in the world. And I'm really lucky enough to have had several of those over the years. Realizing that it's not about you thing, having that moment was a beautiful thing. Mm. That was a real light bulb moment for me. Realizing that entertainment television wasn't fulfilling anymore, and regardless of how
like
much
Top of the Pops and that,
no, it wasn't even Top of the Pops, it was more Saturday Night TV. Doing that and realizing how shallow I felt in that environment and with those people, made me realize it wasn't really for me. Light bulb moments like that, I think, are great. When you make a discovery, it's just the same as being in the therapist chair. When you make a discovery on your own terms, it's a beautiful thing because you're like, oh, crap, I've done that. I've realised that and I'm going to be better for it. Those are the moments where I felt the healthiest and the happiest.
So if you had an opportunity to actually give some advice, encouragement to a truly young person who is developing what will then be their inner selves.
Yeah.
What would that advice be?
Be kind to yourself, man. I think love yourself is overused today, but it's really important. Understanding forgiveness has been a huge breakthrough for me, and it's recent, which is why I'm really glad I've spoken about it today. You know, understanding the person frozen in time that has caused the behavior that maybe doesn't work with you or with me or whatever. Understanding that person and forgiving that person has been a really, really important tool to me. But in terms of advice to both my younger self and to young people listening, younger than me, because I'm cracking on a bit now,
just starting, man.
Yeah, well,
seriously,
is just love yourself.
Yeah,
and it sounds really blanket and easy, but there's a lot to that. You know, the idea of knowing that you're enough is a huge thing. Also, having the balls to say, I don't need anybody else today, is a really, really beautiful thing.
Having the
thing.
Balls or having the vagina? That's the real question.
Having the propensity.
Yeah, having the gender fluid privates.
I get the what point you're that I'm making.
To have the courage.
Is about essentially knowing yourself and loving yourself. And I think through loving yourself, you get to know yourself.
Yeah.
Knowing that you can be okay on your own. And one of the best bits of advice I've had from my more recent therapist and someone who I still speak to now is he calls it leaning into your shadow, like getting to know your shadow.
Yeah, for real.
And that was a real breakthrough for me recently. This idea of being celebrated at your best self is something that we all are, right? When you're on and when you're firing and you're funny and you're
life.
Fun to be around and, you know, and you've showered and like you're your best self.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to talk about you. Everyone wants to celebrate you. Everybody wants to put you on camera or quote you or write about you.
But when you're struggling.
Right. I've always been scared of failure.
Right, yeah.
And I've been scared of... in the past, I was definitely scared of transparency for fear of appearing weak. And those are all things that have changed in my life and things that I've worked on. I think I'm transparent now. I don't have anything to hide. Obviously, there are certain things I won't talk about publicly because they don't just affect me.
Yeah.
There are certain names I won't mention because I respect other people's privacy. And also...
I need to get better at that.
Yeah. But it's that thing of understanding when a story isn't yours to tell.
Trust me.
You know? So if ever I seem guarded or a bit sort of shaky about how I talk about things, that's the only reason why, because of respect for other people. But
that's real.
For me, it's always been about failure and fear. Those are the two things. And getting to the point where you know that failure is actually a key and integral part of success was another one of those light bulb moments. Like, if you don't know what failure tastes like, how do you know what really succeeding actually is?
Trust
you know
me.
And that works in every element of your life, from professional relationships to romantic. You know, you have to fail, otherwise you can't identify what success looks like. And as someone who has always sort of looked around and drawn inspiration not a blueprint, inspiration from the things that I see, it's lovely to have that clarity as to what I should be looking at and what I should be drawing inspiration from. So, yeah, I think if ever there was a shadow, it's that. And to answer your question, to the younger version of myself and to the young listeners, I'd say get to know your shadow. Be as comfortable with yourself at your worst as you are with you at your best, because then you are in the driving seat.
That's hard.
Genuinely, I think if you're able to control how you feel because you know both sides of the coin, no one can determine who you are in any one moment.
Just to finish off, even though you have based this entire, I feel like the theme, the underlying message is actually your complete embracing of the whole truth without actually trying to plug it. It feels like it really is truth that you have searched for and are feeling currently in a collaboration with, which is fantastic.
Everything else is a waste of time, bruv.
But quickly, we have another thing called Whole Hour. Given an hour to be separate from, say, the world of technology, how would you spend your time?
Reading a book, listen to good music. I like to walk.
Yes.
Since we spoke about this on the podcast, actually, you know, when Apple introduced that screen time thing, it made us all very aware of how much we look at our phones. But the thing I really like on there in terms of those stats is when it shows you how many times you pick up your phone.
Yeah.
On average.
Yeah.
It made me feel sick.
Really? So, what was yours?
Last time I checked, so on this last week, on average, it was 145 an hour.
Really?
Times I pick it up, on average. Yeah. It's terrible.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. But again, it's difficult.
I know, but I don't know. I think don't be too hard on yourself. I think like there's, you know, you're in the business.
Well, I was about to give myself a little squeeze because I was going to say I do a lot of my work through my phone. Yeah. So I reply to emails all day. Yeah. Weirdly, a lot of business is done on WhatsApp now. So like I'll talk to producers, I'll talk to directors, I'll talk to my podcast team, I'll talk to everybody on that. So I am picking it up a lot, but I want it to be at least half that.
All right, thank you, Reggie. You are an inspiration, a legend, and I'm very happy to call you a friend. Speak to you soon.
Love, thank you for having me.
Love.
Thank you. I've got a mouthful of dreadlock.
Yo, did you?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Powered by Spirit Studios.